everyone always says Frankenstein is not the name of the monster. Frankenstein's the doctor. Or else they'll say Frankenstein is not the doctor's name. It's the name of the monster, whichever it is. I don't see why it can't be both. People name their kids after themselves all the time. Here, people, they go, I'm Frankenstein and this is my son, Frankenstein Jr. Perhaps they'll call him Frank or something. Frankenstein, and then there's Frankenstein Jr. If Frankenstein's monster grows up to be a doctor, then he might be Dr. Frankenstein as well. That's okay. We're now not that stupid that we can't distinguish between people who happen to have the same or similar names. It's perfectly fine. Perfectly fine. We can call one of them Junior or give one of them a title or shorten their name, whatever. It's perfectly fine. We're not morons. We can figure out how to assemble a son in a lab from bits of dead humans. Or growing a test tube, then I'm sure you can get around the issue of having slightly similar names. It's not a problem at all. It's not a problem at all. Anyway, you make a Frankenstein in a test tube instead of a natural way assembling limbs from different dead humans in the lab. So you're bringing in the nature versus nurture thing, and that's going to be a problem because that's hard to reproduce. It's not a very repeatable experiment then. You would think we'd be more repeatable because you're not using random limbs and random body parts and sticking them together. Well, no. What is the ideal way to make a Frankenstein's monster? Using the scientific method and making it a repeatable process that other scientists can do. Go to a donor bank. Stuff that traditionally a male contributes to the creation of a human. You get that. You publicize. This is from donor number 825. So anyone who wants to repeat this experiment just has to get another sample from donor 825, assuming they consent to this. Donor 825's donations can be frozen and put in a bank somewhere. Some sort of scientific trust can look after it. So anyone who wants to repeat that in their lab can get their hands on that stuff and then use that to create the monster in whatever way it's supposed to be done, presumably by injecting it into a pipette or whatever the... I don't know my laboratory equipment very well, but I do remember two things from chemistry, which I failed. The last 2 years of school, I did chemistry and I got an E in chemistry. An E is a fail. It's between 25% and 39%. I was actually pleasantly surprised. I thought I knew about 10% of chemistry. So when I got an E, which is between 25% and 39%, I was pleasantly surprised. Don't ever let anyone tell you that a fail can't be something you're proud of. I have fond memories of studying or not studying chemistry in school because there's a class being put into because there was nowhere else to go. Just go, this is chemistry, fucker, who gives a shit? That's what I put down for all my answers in the exam. I said, fuck this, who gives a shit? And it turns out between 25% and 39% of the answers were correct. You put down, I don't give a shit. It turns out that's correct. So chemistry is easier than I thought. Maybe it's a natural process to just absorb into your brain somehow. I don't know. There was stuff called dry ice kept in a tank down the back of the room. If you want to freeze something without getting wet, you use dry ice, but it's also very dangerous, apparently. If you touch dry ice, it burns you. It's like getting freezer burn, which I think I could handle. I think I get freezer burn every time I open the freezer here. It's fine. You just get your stuff out of the freezer. Make sure you have a hot cup of coffee ready to warm your hands after your visit to the freezer. It is fine. Not like it's a walk-in freezer. My life is not at risk. I'm just getting stuff out of the freezer. You transfer stuff from the freezer to the fridge. It's like going from the fire into the frying pan, except kind of the opposite, but not the opposite. If you know what I mean. That's a Meatloaf song, isn't it? There's a Meatloaf song. When he did his big comeback, he did Back Out of Hell 2, and he did all this, I will do anything for love, but I won't do that, and all that stuff in the 90s. He had a song on that album called Out of the Frying Pan and Into the Fire. I went something along the lines of this. Out of the frying pan and into the... out of the frying pan and into the out of the frying pan and into the fire. Now, you may have noticed I'm using two harmonicas today simultaneously. Well, I tried to use them simultaneously, but one at each end of my mouth. But there wasn't enough width. My mouth isn't wide enough to have two horizontal harmonicas lined up right beside each other, like two buses arriving at one time, so I kind of had to put them at an angle. Didn't really work out. I was thinking the other day as I could try that. I have an unusual situation at the moment whereby my harmonica that I keep in the other room where I record sometimes is in here. And that's going to be the situation for some time, I think. So as the weeks go by, I might figure out a better way to do dual harmonica. You might be thinking maybe you should figure out how to play one harmonica first before you go on to trying to play two. Well, I've been playing an harmonica on this podcast since 2006 or thereabouts. That's 20 years of harmonica ago. Now, I know I haven't become an expert at it. Let's be honest, I'm not going to get any better at playing that first harmonica. So there's no point just trying to squeeze lemon out of a dry, whatever you do, getting blood out of a stone. So I might as well just move on to the two harmonica thing. I've got the one harmonica thing as far as it'll go. So now we'll try to do the two harmonica thing. But don't worry, I'll take my time with it. But I know people hate it when I rush these things. I'll take my time. I'll take it as a slow growth thing. I am approaching. I've been at the harmonica thing for much of my adult life now. And if I'm ever going to play two harmonicas simultaneously, now's the time to get going on that. Just get it going. Just getting the pot on the stove and just getting the start on it. Anyway, yes, out of the frying pan and into the fire. You're getting stuff out of the freezer and putting it into the fridge where you slowly defrost it. So that's like getting it out of the fire and into the frying pan, except it's the opposite of a frying pan and it's the opposite of a fire, but not really, because you're not getting it from a frying pan into a fire. That's what the opposite would be. But no, the opposite of a... That's the problem. The opposite of out of the frying pan and into the fire is out of the fire and into the frying pan. But that's not what we're doing here, even though we are doing the opposite. We're doing it from the freezer into the fridge. And if you say, what's the opposite of putting something from the freezer into the fridge? You say the opposite of that is putting it from the fridge into the freezer. And that doesn't even remotely resemble putting something from a frying pan into a fire, or a fire into a frying pan. So how is it the opposite? I think the answer to that is that there's more than one type of opposite. Something like that, anyway. Something like that. Why would you let your children listen to this? It's absolute shit, for one thing. Your children have access to some of the finest writers and content makers known to man. Roald Dahl, who could just as easily have spent his life writing all these horror stories and suspense stories like the ones he introduced in Tales of the Unexpected, a kind of English version of The Twilight Zone. He chose to direct his talents towards writing stuff for your child. He wrote some of the most magical tales known to man, and they got turned into movies and books and everything. And you're turning to me for your child's entertainment. No, that's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. There's better stuff available than this for your child. That's like coming to me and asking me to design your child's clothing. No, I can't do that either. I can't provide for your child in any way through this podcast or through my other creative outlets. None of this is something I provide for your child. I won't stop you trying to have your child listen to it if you think it'll benefit them in some way. That's your business. That's between you and your child and your friends who are deciding whether or not to call social services. And they'd know better than me whether or not to do that, because they know you better than me. They probably have them on auto dial. Is it called Ojo Doll? I don't know. I know they used to call this having someone on Ojo Doll in the old days when you had phones. You'd have a preset button. You press this button and it automatically dials. But it didn't even do that. When you had rotary dial telephones, there wasn't something going, oh, I press number one, a little mechanical robotic finger will come out and dial up each digit. No. But when we moved to push-button phones in the 80s, a lot of people had push-button phones in the late 80s. Then you could press hash and then the number one, and that would dial up whoever was your first auto dialing. You'd hear it going beep, 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 and that was automatically pressing the buttons for you. But it wasn't even doing that. It wasn't a robotic finger reaching out and pushing the buttons on your number keypad on your phone. No, it was just doing the electronic stuff that happens in the background normally when you press those buttons. So I don't think you can even call that Ojo Doll. Virtual Ojo Doll, I suppose. But they didn't call it that because people didn't really have an understanding of the concept of virtualness in those days. They thought everything was real and solid. There's no such thing as a virtual concept. There's no such thing as something that's not solid. Even the air was solid in those days. You take in some oxygen in your lungs and they came in the form of solid molecules of smog and smoke and crap. And you hope that in there somewhere there was some oxygen molecules. We assumed in those days even that the oxygen molecules had to be solid. We thought, if I can't feel some dust coming into my lungs, then I'm not breathing, I'm going to die. People would panic. They went for a drive up the mountains and the air was clear. They thought, oh, I don't seem to be getting any oxygen in here. I can't feel any particles coming up through my nostrils. Get back in the car quick, close the windows, put on the air conditioning before we die. That's what they thought. And of course, they were mistaken. No one corrected them on it. He didn't understand the concept of anything virtual at all. They thought if you recorded something off the TV and it wasn't on a big box thing with a roll of tape on it encased in solid plastic, they thought this isn't a recording unless it's on something like that. It couldn't be a virtual thing that came up on an interface that says, oh, look, here's a recording. Tap the recording here with your finger to play it. No, they said that's nothing. That's just light. How can a recording just be light? If there was, there'd have been some confusion as well. In the era of videotape rentals, they didn't have internet yet, but they did have virtual stuff, such as downloads of video programs. You just couldn't get them on the internet. You had to go and get them from a shop. They'd say, I want to rent this. But I don't know if you young people know what a videotape library was like. He had all these displays. He'd go around to all these displays and they had empty boxes. You'd find Groundhog Day or you'd find E.T. the Extraterrestrial or wherever you wanted to rent. You'd pick out the empty box and you'd go up to the checkout and you'd say, I'd like to rent this, please. And they'd disappear into the back of the shop and they'd come back with a tape. And they put that tape into a branded box that had the name of the video shop on it. They didn't even let you use the box that was on the shelf. It went into a different box. We at least expect to get something in the box. It wasn't an empty box that you went home with. It was a branded box with a tape inside it. And that was a solid thing. So in those days, if we had had virtual stuff where they download it onto something, I suppose in a way that's what they were doing. They said, oh, we have a new format now. It's ones and zeros. They'll put the ones and zeros in the box for you and you bring it home. You'd expect to have something in the box. You'd expect a disc or something. I thought this would be more profound, but no, it's not turning out profound at all. I hadn't thought this true, and that's okay because this program doesn't work if I think things true. But on this particular occasion, not thinking it true has led me to not realize that it doesn't make any sense, even as a fun concept. No, it doesn't make any sense at all. I think I was going to try to claim that in those days when we didn't have internet downloads, if we found a new concept that involved downloading stuff, but we had to get the downloads from a shop, we'd be confused because it wouldn't be on a tape or a CD or something. It would just be ones and zeros in a box. Well, of course it wouldn't. It would still be on some sort of cassette or disc or something that it would in the box for you. So that's nonsense. Unless, instead of having tapes and CDs that they rented out, if you bring in your player, whatever contraption you play your horn, and you say, I want to rent this, please, and then they put it onto your thing. They don't use tapes or anything. They download it from their computer directly onto your player that you brought in, and you bring that home. And they say, you don't have to bring that back now. We've loaded it onto your home video player. We've uploaded the program onto that. You can go and bring that home. Well, it'll just expire after a couple of days, but you don't have to return it. Don't worry. You won't get fined if you don't come back with this machine. I suppose they probably understand that. People in the 1980s weren't complete morons. I'm sure they'd have got the hang of the concept somehow. It'd just be slightly different than what they're used to. Just as we got the hang of the concept eventually. It took a while though, because first they set up Netflix, but they didn't set it up as an internet thing. They set it up as a we'll send you the discs through the post thing. That's what Netflix was at the beginning. Because people in the 80s, they didn't have internet yet. I had a thing through the post system. Netflix didn't exist here at the time, but someone else set up a thing through the post system that was just for my country in the 2000s. I thought it was great. I started renting these things through the post. They had a queue online. I'd get two discs at a time. And instead of waiting until I watched the disc and then sending it back in the free post envelope, the day the disc arrived, I'd immediately record the disc onto a cassette, just as if it were something I recorded off the TV. And then I sent the disc back so the next one on my queue could be sent out when that got back. So I would have this thing on the tape ready to watch. Don't worry, I wasn't pirating it or anything. I was just recording it onto videotape so I could watch it and simultaneously send back the DVD they had sent. Don't worry, I didn't bring down Barings Bank or something by doing that. No, you're probably glowing now, thinking, oh Christ, what did he do? No, it was nothing like that. Relax. And in fact, this is all just concept. This isn't a documentary, so none of this happened. Actually, now that I think of it, maybe it didn't happen. Maybe I'm misremembering it. The human memory is notorious for being unreliable. They'll tell you that all the time. They'll tell you, criminal investigators will tell you, the human memory is notoriously unreliable. 10 people watching a crime take place, all from the same angle. One of them will say, oh, that fella, he chopped the fella's head off with an axe or something. And then someone else who was standing right beside him will say, oh, yes, he attacked that fellow with a gun. He hit him over the head with a gun and then he died. Then someone else will say, oh, nothing happened at all. The fellow was just standing there and your man was telling him jokes and they're both laughing. And then I think one of them died from laughing. And then someone else will say, oh, nothing happened here at all. There was nothing to see here. I was watching them both. I was hoping something would happen. Not violent, don't worry. I wasn't hoping a crime would happen. I was here watching these people because I was attending a show. This was a thing in the street. It was some sort of street artist. That's what I thought it was anyway. I saw these two people in the street. One was pointing an object into the other fella's face. And then the other fella was looking panicky. And I thought it was some sort of a card trick. Because your man was panicking, saying, oh, I'm looking at this fella and I can't figure out what card he's showing me. It doesn't look like a card at all. It looks like a gun pointed right into my face. So he's probably mad because I'm trying to guess what card he's holding. Some weird version of poker. What's that thing in the movie about Vietnam or something where they're doing the Russian roulette thing? Is that like poker? I'm not sure. Maybe it is. That's what the fourth witness will be saying. They saw this fella pointing a gun in someone's face, except this fella won't remember it as a gun. He'll remember it as the back of a card or something, a playing card. Misread the situation entirely. And then the fifth witness will be there saying, I don't know what I saw, to be honest. That fella was standing there. He seemed to be pointing a gun at this fella. And as he pointed the gun at this fella, a noise came out from that appeared to be coming from the gun. and the other fella's face exploded. But I didn't see a bullet going through the gun. I think it was inside the gun, it was through that little tube. The vast majority of people in most normal countries have never even handled a gun. They don't know what a gun is. As far as we know, it's like a tube thing. It's like a roll of tin foil that you use to wrap your sandwiches in. If you're rather extravagant, you wrap your sandwiches in sheet metal. What next? The same people who wrap their sandwiches in this sheet metal type of thing you could make a whole car body out of with two rolls. The same people will balk at these beverages that some people like to get that have flakes of gold in them. They say, oh, that's extremely extravagant. What in the name of Christ? Well, no, you're wrapping your sandwiches in sheet metal. It's like you tear off a strip of your car and use it to put your baguette into and bring it to work. Christ almighty, what is wrong with you? What is wrong with you? There's something wrong. Well, not that there's anything wrong with being wrong with you. Being mentally ill or undereducated or of diminished educational ability is not a crime and nothing to be ashamed of. But what is wrong with you as a matter of interest? There's nothing wrong with having something wrong with you. I'm just curious. What is wrong with you? I'd like to learn from it. So what is wrong with you if you're that person? And then the sixth person will be going, oh, hello. Oh, hello, detective. What can I help you with? Because they have a terrible memory. They don't even remember the question. And then they'll remember and they'll say, oh, yes, this fella, he was forging a check. And I could see that he was forging a check because it wasn't even on a checkbook. It was on a sheet of paper. Now, I know anyone who's familiar with old banking laws and things probably knows that there's probably some way you can make a perfectly legitimate check without it being on a printed checkbook that your bank sent you. Well, that's really for businesses who are printing out checks and attaching them to statements. It's not really meant for people to take out a notepad and go, I owe you 60 euros and not only do I owe you it, because an IOU thing is different from a check, isn't it? Yeah, so that's right. So you wouldn't write IOU, you'd write, dear this fella's bank. No, you'd go, dear my bank, this fella's bank has sent you this and that's why you're reading it. Please give them this money from my account. In fact, you wouldn't say please because it's an instruction to your bank. You might say please just out of habit because you're polite. You should probably avoid that. There's times when being polite can cause confusion. So if you're writing a check, it's an order, it's an instruction to your bank. So don't put please on it, because then they'll think it's an optional request. In fact, the bank might think to be responsible bankers, they should think, oh, you won't automatically do this. We should consider his request and decide whether or not it's appropriate to do that, because otherwise we won't be serving him well by just going, this fella says, if he just sends me a thing saying, please give the money. No, it has to be an instruction. Be firm to your bank. This is an instruction. It's like you're giving an instruction to your solicitor, your lawyer. You write a check saying, give this fella this money out of my account. I'm telling you to do it, so don't be all panicky. You don't want the bank to be all panicky when they get this check and they're asked to cash it. You want them to have a firm instructions from you. So that's what the sixth, was it the sixth witness I was talking about? Yeah, the sixth witness saw this fella forging a check. Hopefully the detectives will understand that. They think, wait a minute, this fella was shooting a gun and forging a check and doing whatever the other fella did, the car check thing. How can it all be? Well, that's the point. Human memory is notoriously difficult. You can't trust any of these things. You have no idea what's going on there. No idea what's going on. No idea. The only way you find out what's going on is to do a post-mortem on everyone involved, including the ones who aren't dead. First, you have to ascertain whether anyone died. Are you even investigating a death? You don't know. You don't know what happened. Is there a death? Was there a hold-up? Did someone write a false check? Were people selling individual cans that were only allowed to be sold as part of a multi-pack? You don't know what's happened there. You don't know. You can't rely on people's memories. You can't just ask witnesses and expect to find out for certain. So no, you do post-mortems on everyone living or dying. You might find there's been a murder, but nobody's died yet. And that can happen. So it's a future crime. Someone shot someone, but they haven't died yet. In fact, the bullet hasn't reached them yet. I suppose a bullet could get held up somewhere. It would get wedged in a wire fence somewhere. And then finally breaks free after a change in the air temperature or something and manages to come free. And then it continues on its merry way and then hits someone. That could be a future crime that you're investigating. Hopefully you'd solve it before it gets done. Find this bullet and stop it in its tracks. Maybe get one of those people who does a stage act where they catch a bullet in their teeth. Don't get them to catch the bullet, just get them to advise you on it. Be like consulting someone. Say, we found this bullet, it's in the middle of being shot at someone. It's being slowed down by this barbed wire fence here. Can you advise us on how we might stop it? And of course, this person would say, oh, this is great. I've always wanted a talent that can be used to help the police in some way. Instead of just standing on stage night after night, catching bullets in my teeth. It's exactly like when one of those psychics, they don't want to spend their days standing on the stage going, oh, your father came too. He says he left a lotto ticket in the bottom drawer. And you're all scum and see you in 50 years or whatever. No, they want to do something cool and interesting. So they'd love to be able to assist the police with murders and things. It's exactly like that. Exactly like that. It's no difference whatsoever from whatever the other thing I'm comparing it to is. It's exactly like that. So that's great. Isn't that great? That whole scenario I've created there. I like that. I know I stumbled and didn't necessarily flow very well, but no, I like that scenario I've created. So well done me. I should clarify, when I say that psychics want to assist the police with murders, I don't mean assist them to perform murders or enable murders. No, quite the opposite. They want to assist police in preventing murders, ideally, or catching murderers and solving murders. Ideally, they'd want to prevent murders. Although, how would you do that, though, without engaging the concept of future crime from that movie? Now, it's a great movie, but the problem is Tom Cruise is in it. Does he have any credibility in these matters anymore? I don't think he has. I don't want any concept that's being brought to me through a movie featuring Tom Cruise. Or any of his ideas, or any of a writer's ideas who saw fit to put Tom Cruise in, or who Tom Cruise respects. No, thank you very much. No, thank you very much. But the psychics wouldn't be saying, oh, there's someone's going to murder this fella the day after tomorrow. You're probably thinking, how would the police get to the point where they're having a meeting with this psychic about upcoming murders? Well, exactly. No, that's why we don't want to do the future crime system from that movie. Wait, is it Tom Cruise who's in it? If it's not, then please disregard all my commentary about that movie. It's perfectly fine if he's not in it. I know that movie where the cops were investigating future crimes and there's three sort of psychic future predictors who float in a tank somewhere. And they go chasing after people who they've decided are going to create murders because the psychics have seen a video of them in their heads doing the murder in the future. And of course, that's horrific. That's horrific. We don't want to be putting people in jail for future crimes. No. If a psychic can go to the police and say, this fella who you're looking for who's missing, he's still alive, but 3 days from now he's going to be gunned down in cold blood. I know that sounds a bit strange. This fella has run away to join a circus and it's all going fine so far, but it's going to take a downturn about 3 days from now. That would be a positive way in which the psychic can help the police, assuming the psychic can give them enough information to go and prevent this murder, find out where this fella is, which circus. It's not much use if you can't say which circus he's joined. But there's circuses everywhere. Every country has circuses. There's at least two or three circuses in this country, I believe. Or is there? Wait, are they foreign circuses who go around and just tour? Is there just 3 circuses in the world and they all just come around to every town every week? I don't know. I think there's at least 1 or 2 or 3 circuses in this country. Or at least there were. Are they gone out of business? I don't know. I'm sure there must be circuses still. Some fella's missing and the psychic can say he's gone off to join a circus, but they can't say which circus. I suppose that's a bad example. It's not that impractical to have the detective's assistant call up all of the circuses in that region. You can narrow it down somehow. So the circus is a bad example. But let's say the psychic said they'd run away to join a petrol station forecourt shop. There's literally tens of thousands of them in this country alone. They say they'd run away to work in a Starbucks. That wouldn't narrow it down at all. If it was some other coffee shop, that wouldn't narrow it down because they have fewer branches. Well, if you run away to join the Starbucks, that could be anywhere. What are there, 20,000 or something now? Could the psychic at least narrow it down, say it's a franchise Starbucks or it's a proper one owned directly by the company? That's something I've learned incidentally by enjoying the content created by Winter. Is this fella Winter from Starbucks Everywhere, I think is his website. There was a documentary movie made about him many years ago. This fella Winter, that's his name, he goes by Winter. He's been on a years long mission to visit every Starbucks in America and many of them abroad as well. He's visited thousands. He makes a distinction between company-owned Starbucks and ones that are franchises, something like that. He does make a distinction. I think he kind of looks down on the ones that are very franchisey. They're a couple of steps away from the company somehow. They're franchisees. And he kind of makes a distinction. So it's like that. If the psychic could make a distinction, at least they'd say he'd run off to join the McDonald's or he's run off to join the Starbucks. Could they say, is it a franchise Starbucks or is it a company-owned Starbucks? Is it one of those fake Starbucks they have maybe in other countries? Like the way they have a King Burger in some countries and you know it's got no connection to Burger King at all. Is it like that? You come across shops here. You have the well-known convenience store brand, Centra. There's a shop in Newtown, Mount Kennedy, near here called Centra. But it's spelled with an S, and the branding is very different. And you tell immediately it's very much not part of the Centra brand. That sort of thing. Or like when you used to get a Sunny Walkman in one of the dodgier shops, Sunny, instead of a Sony. Sony were considered more legitimate in those days. At least in the area of personal stereo cassette players. And let's not go down the road of talking about personal stereo cassette players again. So we did that last week and we've done it several times in the last couple of years since the comeback. So let's not do that. It's bad enough when I used to do it in the old days when this podcast began and the Sony Walkman was already pretty much a thing of the past. In fact, the Apple iPod wasn't much longer for this world. And still I'd go on about personal stereo. It was every 5 minutes. It was my personal stereo Walkman that I had in 1989. In fact, I didn't even have it until. Now we're doing it again. No, let's not do that. Because I do that and then I get on to, now that's what I call Music 16, which I did a few weeks ago and I listened back when editing and I realised pretty much all of the songs that I claimed were on that album, I was misremembering them from Now 17 or something. I didn't like Now 17. I got Now 16. That's the one I remember because I had it with my first Walkman. It did indeed have some of the songs I mentioned. It had Leave a Light On by Belinda Carlisle. It had that thing with Paula Abdul and the fake talking humanoid cat who she's supposedly dating. And they're saying opposites attract, presumably because the cat is male, I don't know, and has twice as many legs. I didn't mention that song at the time, but perhaps I should have, because some of the other songs I mentioned, like the Turtle Power song, I'm pretty sure that now that was from Now 17, not Now 16 at all. So that was nonsense. A misleading, inaccurate nonsense. The Now brand of music compilation albums is confusing enough as it is nowadays because they started up in America. We're up to Now 100 and something and America is up to what? Now 51 or something? I don't know. As usual, you Americans, you get things and you think, oh, I wonder if the rest of the world knows about this Now thing. It's up to Now 51, isn't it? Great. No, it's not great. Ours is streets ahead of yours. We are up to now 100 and something. Now, I don't know if anyone buys it anymore, or if it exists in record shops or anything as he used to. I associate now with a thing with two cassette tapes in it. Rather confusing, as a matter of fact, because you get these compilation albums. It usually be two cassette tapes. The first cassette tape would have a side one and a side two. And sometimes the second cassette tape would say side three and side four. Now, the logic and the geometry of that don't add up. I think we all know that. Those of us who have even the slightest understanding of geometry and 3D and how many sides something can have, I think we all know that's nonsense. But we also know it made some sense as well. You call it side one and side two, and then cassette two is side one and side two as well. Lead to more confusion than is necessary. So I suppose, to be fair, it wasn't unreasonable of them to do it that way, I suppose, to be fair. Do young people still run away to join the circus? I wonder about that. Why would you need to run away to do that? It literally comes to your town. It's on tour. It's like a touring hiring. Maybe they don't bring the HR department on tour with them. Maybe that's run from a head office somewhere. Well, wait, if you're a circus and you have a head office, that implies you have branches all over the place. But you don't. You don't. You're a travelling circus. Maybe you have temporary branches. They're pop-up branches, I suppose. Like the way they have pop-up stores now. So if you're a circus, you're a pop-up circus, really. You're popping into existence somewhere and then disappearing. Just like that thing with the, you know, the quantum physics. I make vague reference to it somewhere else here. I think I just say dead cats and Schrodinger and stuff. But there's also stuff about popping into and out of existence. You don't say, oh, we have 300 circus branches. Every major town we have a circus. It's just that they only operate for a couple of days every 5 years, each branch. And then they pop out of existence for another few years. That's not a real branch network at all. You're no fooling nobody, even if you have a head office and a HR thing there. So if you run away to join the circus, what are you running to? If you run away, you don't have a vehicle, probably. So you get on the next bus, you say, oh, I think that circus is going out to that town there. So I'll get the bus there and hope to overtake it and get there before it lands. The animals probably just think they're standing in a truck somewhere. It's like when you move house from one part of the country to the other. You bring your cat with you in a carrier and then you slowly introduce it to the new house. It thinks it's being brought into a whole different realm of existence. It has no concept of travelling along a motorway. About 5 years ago, we moved to this place here and brought some cats with us. I think they think the universe just disappeared out of existence and then they probably don't think they're even the same cats. They're pretty much airheads compared to humans, which would explain why I had to spend several minutes in here trying to get one to leave, despite it wanting to leave and despite it meowing at me crying to leave. Cats sometimes can be airheads about these things. You introduce it to the new house, starts learning its universe from scratch all over again. You introduce it one room at a time because you don't want to overload its tiny brain with the concept of having more than one room, which makes zero sense. If you introduce something to just one room, it doesn't know that's a room until you introduce it to a second room. That doesn't make sense. You have to introduce at least two rooms at a time or else it doesn't understand the concept of rooms. We've a lot to get on with today. Items that need to be attended to, issues that need to be addressed. We've got lots and lots of topics. We've got topics coming out of, the following sip of water. There you go. I've actually already covered that topic in a separate segment, which may be later on or earlier on, or not at all. I haven't listened back to it. It may not be usable, or it might be usable. Should I do more about water now? There's only so much you can say about water. It's a beverage and a cleansing solution. You can get air out of water. Or can you? I don't know. The people who are going to Mars, are they bringing water with them? I'm not sure. Or are they bringing air with them? Perhaps the plan is to have found water before they get there using robots. It's absolutely fucking ridiculous. They're sending these robots to her on wheels, the remote control. They send a signal to a robot on Mars. It takes several minutes for the instruction to get there, so they're somewhat autonomous. So you have these robots going around on Mars looking for water, and what are they going to do when they find it? First thing you know, anyone who has electronics, I've dropped phones in water. It's not good. I presume a Martian rover thing is pretty much full of electronics. That's not good to have that in contact with water. I don't mean it'll get injured by electrocution. No, robots don't have feelings like that. Oh, that's the worst thing. Robots don't have feelings, so they are in just as much danger as those kids you hear about who are born with that condition whereby they don't feel pain. You don't feel pain, but you can get injured and you don't know that you've been injured, so you carry on. It's like you're bleeding internally and you've no idea it's happening. You could end up dead. So if you're one of these robots that can't feel anything, you've no idea you've been damaged. You've no idea, you're just sitting there, vaguely curious about whatever you've been programmed to be vaguely curious about. Which is a weird thing to do, I suppose. No, they program you to be curious about things, they don't put on a level, be vaguely curious. Or maybe they do, maybe they prioritize all the things they want you to be curious about. But they don't want you to go around thinking, oh, if I touch this, will it hurt? No. But that would be a useful thing to have. If you have a robot who could touch something and then experience pain because it's extremely hot or it's extremely heavy or whatever it is, that would be useful. Say, robot, find out whether this thing is too hot by touching it. And then the robot touches and experiences pain. Well, it's not real pain, of course. It's artificial, so it doesn't really hurt. The robot doesn't really give a shit whether it experiences pain or not. So when the robot feels pain, it's not really feeling pain. It's going, oh, that's interesting. That thing is pulsing in my brain. That's telling me there's something happening down here at my left foot. I've dipped into a molten puddle of volcano juice. That's interesting. It's not going, ow, that's horrible pain. No. I suppose to call it pain is misleading. Well, who are you misleading? You're not misleading the robot. It's not some election where you have to convince the robot about stuff. No, so you're not misleading anyone. The robot is an object that you control. It's like when you go away. If you're one of these people who goes away and you point a camera at your cats to watch them and make sure nobody's stealing them and make sure someone's feeding them and making sure they're not locked in somewhere accidentally, that they're not supposed to be locked in. People do that on their webcam on their phone. So they take out their phone and they'll dial up the webcam thing and they say, oh, look, there's the cat cam. Here's the cat. Why am I able to see the cat cam on this? Where's the picture coming from? And then you realise a signal is coming from inside the house. Well, that's a meaningless phrase. I don't know why that's relevant here. If that did happen, you dialed into your cat webcam and you noticed you could see the cat webcam, I suppose that would mean your cat has managed to knock something off the shelf that had a mirror on it, and the mirror is now sitting in front of the camera. So when you look at the camera is showing you itself. I suppose that could happen. Or something more likely, something's gone wrong with the camera. It's being knocked over by a cat and the lens has somehow reversed itself. So the camera is looking at itself. Is that possible? Maybe. I don't know. I'm sure there's some way you could do that. If you wanted to, but you wouldn't want to. That'd be ridiculous. Well, it's like that. Going to Mars is like that. The Mars rover is pretty much a cat camera on another planet. It's a bit different from the cat webcam thing, because you're not looking at your own home where your cats are. No, in the Mars camera, the Mars rover thing, it's the equivalent of sending your cats to another planet and then sending a camera to look at the cats, except the camera is the cats. You're not really, the purpose of the exercise isn't to look at the cats in that instance. The purpose is to look at whatever your cat is seeing. So the Martian rover is the cat, But you don't care about the cat itself. You care about what the cat is seeing. You want the cat to send back information and data, particularly if it finds water. If the cat that you send to Mars finds water, you want to know where it is. You don't want to just look at a cat drinking water. No, especially in this instance, because it's not a cat, it's a robot. Don't worry, I'm not suggesting that NASA sends a cat to Mars and lets it roam around trying to find water for you until it dies after failing to do so. No, that's not what I'm suggesting at all. I'm talking about the Mars rover, it's a robot. I'm making an analogy between that and a cat. And what's the opposite of an analogy? Where you say it's different from that. Because it is somewhat different from watching your cat on a camera. Because the cat is at home in your house and you know about your house. You don't know about Mars. And that's why you're not sending a real cat there. No proper cat owner and no trustworthy scientist will be sending their cat to Mars like that. I know they put dogs into space. Yes. Or usually explode or something, don't they? When they put dogs into space, usually the plan is to let them explode at some point. Humanely explode. When they send dogs into space, the plan is to study them, see how they respond to space and stuff. And then eventually they don't come back. They humanely explode the dog in space and then he learns stuff from that. Learn as much as he can from that. Once upon a time, there was a dog. A dog. A dog. A dog. A dog. A dog. Basically a dog. And this dog, he was walking along the road one day, minding his own business, stopping every few seconds to lift up one of his legs, which is apparently where the urine comes out on a dog. On a dog, the urine comes out from under one of the legs. I suppose that's reasonable. When we drive cars, the exhaust comes out at the back. On a car, the place where you put the fuel in is usually at one corner of the car, the back left or the back right or somewhere like that. I was going to say that I suppose it's reasonable on a dog for it to be under one of the legs, one of the hind corner legs. Well, no, of course, waste disposal is not the same thing as fuel injection. No, of course, liquid waste disposal on a dog is a very, very different concept to fuel intake on a car. But still, apparently the equipment for extinguishing liquid waste from a dog is placed on one of the corners of the dogs. Since all of the legs are on corners of the dog, a dog is essentially a four-cornered vehicle or creature, whatever you want to call it. A dog has four corners, although now that I think about it, that's not right at all. It's not a two-dimensional creature. A dog has at least eight corners. But on each of the four bottom corners on the underside of the dog, there's a leg. Look at your coffee table now. If you have a coffee table, look at your coffee table. It's got four legs. Now, those are the equivalent of the legs on the dog. They come out on the underside on each corner, roughly each corner. I know a dog isn't exactly cuboid, but it's similar enough. And at the top of the... I had to go extinguish a cat. It was proving difficult to locate. Anyway, this dog table that you have, this dog coffee table, well, it's a normal coffee table. In this instance, I'm asking you to use it as your basis for imagining the shape of a dog, especially if you're not familiar with dogs and you have a coffee table or any kind of a rectangular table, I suppose. You look at the coffee table, the four legs. You have the four legs there. Roughly one coming out of each corner of the dog. Ignore the tail for the moment because your coffee table hobby doesn't have a tail, does it? No. The important thing is the top of the table, that's the torso of the dog. Now on a coffee table, the torso is a lot thinner than it should be. It's more of a flat thing. A torso on a dog would be a few inches high. It would fill up a lot of air space above the four legs. It wouldn't be just a flat thing like that. So I suppose, perhaps, if you have a coffee table that's more box-shaped, as a table and a shelf underneath, something along those lines, that would be more appropriate to line your furniture up with the anatomy of a dog. And why are we doing that? I've forgotten. I was distracted there for a moment. I had to leave the room for a minute to try and figure out where the meowing was coming from. There was a meowing coming from somewhere. Wasn't obvious. It was only apparent when I put on the headphones and I could hear meowing over this microphone. It was picking up from somewhere, amplifying it. But then when I took off the headphones, the meowing disappeared. And this cat was using my recording equipment as an amplifier. Which means if this thing isn't switched on and plugged in and running, that cat doesn't get heard at all. That cat thinks I'm providing an outlet for it. No, I'm not providing an outlet for you, cat. If you can't competently meow and make yourself heard without using a podcasting studio, then you're a waste of space. A waste of... Learn to meow properly. Amplify your meow if you get stuck. I suppose you only need meowing when you're trapped in here when I close the door. And that only happens when I happen to be podcasting. So I suppose in a way it's you're being quite reasonable in not learning to meow naturally through your normal voice box because you don't need to. Unlike your natural habitat in the jungle, there's always podcasting equipment up and running at the times when you need it. Of course, this would be no use to you in the jungle. In the jungle, if you got a podcasting microphone and a tablet connected to the microphone, as I have here, clamped to a desk and a phone beside it to monitor the uploads to Dropbox, if you had that in the jungle, that wouldn't help you at all, cat. No, that'd be of no use to you whatsoever. Even if it was all up and running, you kept a battery pack or something. You switched it on and started running it when you needed it, and then you use it to amplify your voice to say, I'm locked in here somewhere or I'm in distress. That wouldn't help you at all, because there needs to be someone listening to you through the headphones. I wouldn't be there. I wouldn't be doing this in a jungle, because that's not my natural habitat. This is as close to my natural habitat as I guess. This room here. Let's not go into the room thing. We're always going on about the fucking room. It's just a room. It's a spare room in the back of a house. Just a place where cats go to sleep. And for a couple of hours every week or two, they're asked to leave. And then they just decide, no, I'm not going to leave. I'm going to wait until I'm locked in. And then I'll make my presence felt. And I'll say, I'm in distress because I've been left in here. I can't stand to be in the room with you. That's what they're saying when they're meowing in here. They meow and they say, I cannot stand the idea of being locked in this room with you for the next 2 to 3 hours while you talk shit, while you fill up on water as if that's your beverage of choice. We all know you've been drinking coffee for hours and energy drinks, but no, you pour a glass of water. As if you're one of these water drinkers. Watch a thing on TV now. Some comedian comes on and he comes out with his glass of water, his bottle of water and his stool that he's never going to sit on, but he used that as a table. He carries that out to the stage, makes a big deal of setting up his stall. He's only playing for time while the audience settles down and is ready for him to start addressing them. Takes out his water glass. These water glasses that these people use on these live comedy shows, I don't understand it. They have a glass of water or some beverage. They take a tiny sip out of it every half hour or so. And when they're doing it, they look like they're guilty. They're saying, oh, I shouldn't be doing this. I'm drinking on the job. I'm having a sip of water on the job. Absolutely appalling. Probably because they heard some other comedian once going on about how the young generation don't go anywhere without their water now. They say, oh, these young people, they're going around with this H2O in a bottle drinking it all the time. When I was a child, we didn't drink water at all. That's what they say. They say, when I was a child, I didn't drink water at all. During the school summer holidays, we went out to play after breakfast at 7 o'clock in the morning. We went and played in a ditch somewhere. Got sunstroke and heat stroke and ran around the place on bicycles and ran each other over with our bicycles. We'd go home in the evening and then we'd have a sip of water from the kitchen tap. That's what they say. And we're supposed to be impressed by that. No, you were going around dehydrating yourself needlessly. Nothing wrong with drinking a load of water. Bring a load of bottled water out with you. especially you Americans, you have a climate there. We don't have a climate here. It's mild all the time. When we foreigners go to America, if you go any time between April and November, first thing that happens is we start sweating. Second thing that happens is we start to die from dehydration. No, we bring a bottle of water out with us. And we always make sure we're within 10 minutes of one of your air-conditioned pharmacies. If we've been there before, we know what we have to do. Keep a huge bottle of water in your backpack and keep near a pharmacy. Not for the drugs, for the air conditioning. These people, though, they'll say, no, in my day, we dehydrated ourselves. We played in ditches. We ran around hitting balls around on the road. We got run over 5 times a day, but he didn't hear anyone complaining. No. They'll say, today's children are mollycoddled. So what? So what? Just because your parents didn't give a shit about you or your health. No. Stop that. Anyway, these comedians, they'll come on, they'll set up their water thing. You see them every half hour, they'll pick up their glass. I obsess over this. I watch them with this glass that they pick up. They look like they feel very guilty about it. They think, oh Christ, I'm supposed to be performing here. I shouldn't be forcing the audience to see me taking a sip of water here. That's like making them watch me eat. It's like I'm performing on the toilet, expecting them to watch me do my ablutions while I address them. It's very rude of me. I shouldn't be doing this. And you see them, they go, oh no. I'll tell a joke and I'll measure out a joke where I know they're going to laugh for a second or two. And then while they're laughing, I'll turn my back to them and hope they don't notice that that's quite rude as well. And I'll take a sniff of the glass. I'll try and inhale a few drops of water into my nose. And then hopefully that will eventually drip down towards my mouth. I'll keep my lower lip out a bit and hope to catch some moisture from that. I hope to Christ nobody notices. As I don't want people going out to the ticket office saying, no, I want a refund. This fella's drinking water when he's supposed to be working. No, it's disgusting, they say. Absolutely disgusting. He should be there drenched in sweat, dying from dehydration. He should not be drinking water. That's what they'll say. Same people then. They'll get on the plane and they go 5 minutes without a beverage and they think they're dying. Well, first thing they'll do, before they get on this plane, this sardine thing, the first thing they'll do is load up on coffee and say, I'm about to spend 3 hours in a sardine tin with 500 people. I think I'll load up on caffeine. That'll make for a nice, relaxing journey. I want to be wide awake. No, do that before your podcast. Don't do it before getting on the plane. Unless you have a private jet. Or unless you're the pilot, I suppose. If you're the pilot, have a bit of caffeine. But don't overdo it. No. Don't overdo that. Know when to load up on beverages and when not to. You don't load up on beverages before a plane flight. If anything, load up on a very, very moderate amount of alcohol. Keep it very light so you don't make a fucking idiot or a nuisance of yourself. Have a tiny amount of alcohol. Perhaps a sleep aid. Well, depends. Are you the pilot in charge or are you the co-pilot? I don't know, because they swap their roles around sometimes and say, I'll be the main pilot going out the way, and on the return journey, you can be the main pilot, and I'll pretend not to be 60 years your senior with 40 years of captain experience, because you need some experience as the main pilot so you can pass your maths test or something and get your accreditation and whatever it is you're learning to do. What are you learning to do as a matter of interest? Oh, yes, you're learning to fly a plane. Oh, that's right. I forgot. You're learning to fly a plane. Well, that's something I can help you with. That's something I can help you with as the captain of a plane. I can help you with that. I'll sign over the responsibilities of driving the plane for an hour or two, unless it gets difficult. If we get to a place where you have to land at an airport or something, I'll take over. Until then, yes, we'll give you some experience on the clock that you can put down on your sheet saying, I flew a plane for a few hours. And then eventually that all adds up. Now, while the co-pilot is doing that, of course, the captain does the job of the co-pilot. He does all the other stuff. He does the checklists or he does whatever the person who's not driving is doing. It's usually in support of the driving functions. Oh, why am I telling you this? I don't know. You all probably already know. You're probably all pilots. You listen to this during your downtime. You go on some big long transatlantic voyage in the air. Well, that's what it is. It's a voyage in the air. You go on a space voyage. You can call that a voyage. You go on a sea voyage and discover America. They call that a voyage. But if you go in the air, that's a voyage too. If you go in a balloon, that's a voyage. Well, wait, is it? No. If you go in a balloon, you're a gas. This is a load of bollocks.
Into your head.
Anyway, this coffee table of yours, it's the shape of a dog. It's just not quite the dimensions of a dog, three-dimensionally. Because if your dog's torso was only an inch high and flat on the top and flat on the bottom, firstly, that would be some sort of weird new breed that you've probably purchased somewhere, have you? You've probably purchased it somewhere, the same place where you get those sausage dogs or those toy dogs that they people like to get, that they put a ribbon on and they enter them into shows and say, here's our dog. We want everyone to see our dog. We didn't want to get a child and put the child into these shows where they get a four-year-old child and they teach it to sing and wear wigs and perform and give funny answers to judges. Most parents don't want to put their children into pageants, and most normal parents don't feel the need to replace that with a dog. At least the ones who are doing it with a dog, they're doing it because they don't want to put a child through that. They get a dog instead. And they don't want to put a normal dog through that. They get a dog who's being specially bred to tolerate that kind of shit. They get some sort of toy dog. It's not really a toy dog. It's actually a dog. But it's being bred to certain specifications. At least they're not breeding the dog to eat children. They're breeding the dog to look nice in pageants. So I suppose that's a slight improvement on the dog breeding tradition. People go around breeding these dogs, like making Frankenstein's monster, except if Frankenstein's monster wasn't bits of old corpses glued together in a lab by Dr. Frankenstein. Instead, it was grown in a test tube. If you grew a Frankenstein in a test tube, you'd have better results. At least you'd have something that's very important in science. You'd have repeatable results. An experiment needs to be repeatable. If you're going to say, I created this thing in the lab, I did this experiment and I made a discovery, but no one else can do it. No, you can say, I did this in my lab and the other scientist who wants to test my conclusions can do the same experiment in their lab. It's like when Einstein would come along, he'd say shit like, E equals MC squared. You can figure that out by doing 10 to the power of 7.9. And then do all this stuff I put on the board here in barely legible equations. But technically, that's reproducible. Any other maths genius who's like me can do the same experiments and come to the same conclusion that E equals MC squared. So that's a reproducible, repeatable experiment. Now, the scientist would have to have the same upbringing as Einstein. He'd have to be educated and have the same upbringing and perhaps spend a couple of years working in the patent office. It's a nurture versus nature thing. You need to get all the same nurture and nature that Einstein got. I don't know if Einstein got nature or nurture. So whether it's nature or nurture, you have to get that. And since we haven't figured out yet whether it's nature or nurture, because our scientists are too busy trying to figure out these equations that Einstein did, we have to just assume that it's either nature or nurture or a combination. So when we're reproducing Einstein's experiments, we have to put our scientists or mathematicians through the same upbringing that Einstein had, have him live in Germany and then have him move to America after Hitler invades or something, or oh, wherever. Wait a minute. Did Einstein live in Germany? He lived somewhere whereby his presence was considered undesirable to him because of Hitler's activities, and he left there and then went to America or something like that. This isn't a biography of Einstein. Suffice to say, any scientist who wants to reproduce Einstein's work has to have the same experiences that Einstein had, same upbringing. finish up wherever Einstein was when he came up with whatever equation you're trying to reproduce. Get the same chalkboard, the same type of chalks, learn how to do similar handwriting, find out what Einstein used to have for breakfast. I suppose after he moved to America, he probably had a different kind of diet. They have different types of breakfast in America. They make pancakes and then they make syrup. What else? They make things called sausage. Well, it's not like any sausage we know over here where I live. No, over here a sausage is a thing called a sausage. It's made from what you Americans might call sausage meat. Well, it's not a round, flat thing. No, it's a sausage. It's a sausage-shaped thing. Well, you have a thing called a sausage patty. Now, patty is, firstly, patty was the name of a late aunt of mine. It was short for Patricia, if I remember rightly. So you're naming your sausage burger slab thing. You're naming that Patricia. Is that really what you want to do? I think what problem a lot of you Americans have, you think patty is just short for Patrick. You display that lack of understanding when you say St. Patty's Day and treat it as if it's interchangeable with St. Paddy's Day and St. Patrick's Day. It's not. It's a completely different thing. It's not even the same gender. I had an aunt, Patricia. She was married to a fella called Patrick. He was called Paddy and she was called Patty. Unless you're suggesting they were identical twins who then got married. In which case, that's rather insulting. Don't do that. No. Wait a minute. Why would they be identical twins just because they have similar names that you consider the same? Oh, yes, I'm claiming this. You, as an American, probably think that if someone is called Patty and someone is called Paddy and they're married, they must be twins or something because they're the same person, essentially. Well, that's rather ignorant of you, if you don't mind me saying so. Anyway, thankfully with Einstein, I think this is the attraction. His stuff that he does seems so reliable, and we think he's quite good at all this stuff. We trust him, so we don't feel the need to reproduce all his experiments. I think that's why we're attracted towards the work of Einstein. He seems to know what he's doing, so we say, no, we don't need to go into our lab and reproduce this work. He seems to know what he's doing. Except the dead cat fella. For some reason, he thought, no, this Einstein fella, I'm going to go talking about dead cats. Oh, wait, was he before? No, the dead cat fella started going on about dead cats because he was trying to mock someone. I don't know if it was Einstein or someone else, but he was trying to mock this theory. He was trying to say this whole idea of things being in two states at the same time makes about as much sense as having a cat who's dead and alive at the same time. Suffice to say, he's a lunatic. That's like having a cat meowing who you can only hear over your microphone and you interrupt your podcast for 5 minutes to try and figure out whether he's in the room or not in the room. It's exactly like that. Is this reproducible in a lab? This segment, it probably is. So you can probably train your parrot to do this. Wait, is that a compliment or an insult? If you tell someone, my parrot could perform your podcast on demand if necessary. Well, I don't know why it would be necessary. There's a thing with AI now. You can feed your podcast into a thing and it'll produce it in another language. It'll do your voice in another language and you can put that out to the foreigners and they'll say, oh, look, this fella, he is very good whatever our language is, because they hear the podcaster in a different language in the same voice being created by artificial intelligence. And everybody thinks, that's great. That's great. Everyone is falling for it. They say, that's great. They say, it's absolutely fucking fantastic. Because everyone loves AI. Everyone thinks AI is great. I know this because I experimented with AI album art a couple of years ago for this podcast. And everyone without exception said, that's absolutely fucking great. Except, no, they didn't. They did not. Now, I know what you're thinking there. You're thinking, what if I'm donor 825 and I don't want to be used for repeated experiments involving the creation of a monster? You're literally creating a monster. I know people say figuratively, you're creating a monster with this thing. This concept, you're creating a monster. That's what you're doing. Some movie, perhaps, that's a big hit and then it becomes a franchise. They go, you've created a monster. But that's not what the people are talking about here. They're saying you're literally creating a monster with what I've donated to the sperm bank. And people understandably have an issue with that. To say, if I donate something, I want control over how it's used. Just like when I make a donation to my local charity shop, I go down with a pile of old shit that I'm throwing out, perhaps some old CDs, or perhaps some old books, or perhaps some old clothes that don't fit me anymore, or fit me a bit too well because they've become baggy and I've become baggy. You expect to have control over how those are used. Oh wait, no you don't, because that's fucking ridiculous. You don't. You do not expect to have control over how your old clothes are used in the charity shop. Or apparently, no, if it's stuff that you've squirted into a tube and intentionally gone and donated for the purpose of creating life, you get all weird about it. You think, no, don't create any monsters with this. I want to use to create only normal human beings. No experimentation. No creating monsters. Maybe it's a branding issue. Maybe the scientists shouldn't call this creating a monster. Perhaps they should just say perfecting life. The term monster carries baggage. It carries baggage. They're going right back to the early days of horror and science fiction. That's what we associate the term monster with. We associate it with early science fiction books, like, for example, what's widely considered to be the very first ever work of science fiction, which is Frankenstein. So it has those connotations. Don't call it creating a monster. Call it creating life and experimenting with it. Say you're creating human life or some sort of life. Can you call it human life when it's a monster? I don't know. We have humans who are monsters. Well, again, that's part of the branding problem. You don't want to tell people, I'm creating a monster, but don't worry, it's human. It's going to be a human monster. It's not going to be some big, horrible thing with teeth and, I don't know, a fire-breathing dragon or something. No, don't worry. It'll be a human monster that we create with your donation that you're apparently so particular about that you need control over what species it's used to create. Is a monster a species? No, a monster is just a term you use to describe. It's more of an adverb. Not an adverb. What's the thing that's an adverb but it's for nouns? Ah, you know, it's descriptive. It's descriptive. Adjective, is it? I don't know. Yes, that's what you say, a monster. There isn't a breed of animal called a monster. Now, there probably is one called a dragon. There isn't a fire-breathing dragon. When you call someone a fire-breathing dragon, you're not saying you're a fire-breathing dragon. No, you're saying you're a bit of a cunt. That's what you're saying. And it's similar with monster. When you refer to something as a monster, you don't usually mean it as a species. No, you're saying someone is a monster. It doesn't necessarily have to be a human who you're calling a monster. You could have a cat who's a monster. You'd have a dog who's a monster. You could probably have a fire-breathing dragon who's a monster in that they're difficult to deal with if you're one of the other fire-breathing dragons. I don't know if fire-breathing dragons live a communal life where they like wasps or something where they live in a community. Assume for the moment that fire-breathing dragons, at least in the wild, live together in packs. So if you have a fire-breathing dragon who's difficult to get on with, who the other fire-breathing dragons don't like very much, and they don't like having to deal with them, they might say, that fire-breathing dragon over there, he's a bit of a monster. Or they might say, he's a fire-breathing dragon. So they can't call him a fire-breathing dragon as a term of abuse, because that'll just cause confusion. So they'll probably say, that fire-breathing dragon we live with, he's a monster. If there are a community of monsters and they have one monster who they find particularly difficult to deal with, they don't say, oh, that monster we live with, he's a monster, isn't he? No, they'll say he's a fire-breathing dragon. Now, you're probably wondering, why would there be a monster who's a monster to live with, who the other monsters consider a bit of a monster to deal with? Well, maybe he's difficult because he's not monstery enough. That causes problems when they have meetings. This monster just isn't a team player, perhaps, so he's not monstery. Wait a minute, though. If being a team player involves being monstery, Does that mean that people are not monsters until they come together? Maybe that's the case. How do I think about it? If you're a community of monsters and you find out when one of the monsters isn't being monstery enough, he's considered an asshole, he's not a team player. That implies that monsters only become monsters when they live together in groups. And that's very similar to humans, as we have mob rule when we come together and we don't have that individually. People will start riots when they come together. People who in their normal lives might not ever dream of burning a car out or something, they get all hyped up when they come together as a mob and that happens. So monsters are very similar to humans in that way. If that's the case, and that is all assumption, of course. It's all assumption. I'm not a monster expert of any kind. If you ever have an opportunity to experience traveling in a lifeboat, like the sort of thing they have on the Titanic or on commercial planes, there's an inflatable thing. It serves as an inflatable escape ramp, but can also detach and become a dinghy. That's a lifeboat as well. Or you might have an opportunity to travel on a... I say travel. You're not really traveling when you get into a lifeboat, no. You're just existing and hoping to continue existing. You get into the lifeboat and it floats and you just sit there and kind of wait, usually. Anyway, if you ever have an opportunity to travel on a lifeboat, I would recommend accepting it. Everyone isn't a big adventurer. We don't want to accept every opportunity that comes along. Someone says, you want to climb Mount Everest? You say no. Most people will say no to that. That's understandable. Someone says, you want to come to Mount Everest? You say no. That's not me. I don't do things like that. Or they might say, do you want to come on a 200-mile non-stop run of the kind depicted in that Stephen King novella that he wrote under a different name? There was a period when this publisher were sick to death of Stephen King. He said, no, you can't be just giving us a book every 5 minutes, no. So he went and started writing stuff under the name Richard Bachman. And one of the things he wrote was called The Long Walk. It was a bit like Hunger Games. They have all these people, mostly from poor families, 100 of them, on this marathon. And the idea is you keep walking. They walk and walk and walk for several days. And the last person left walking gets to not be shot in the head. That's the general plot of that novella. Did I say novella? I think I said novella. Is that what it is? I suppose a short novel. Well, short by Stephen King standards, because there was part of a book that had 4 stories in it, which I might call novellas. But a lot of normal authors have novels that are that length all the time, and it's considered a normal novel length, because it's not 980 million pages long. No. I know, if you might be invited to go on a walk like that, and understandably you say, no, thank you, that's not my thing, or I'm not that desperate for the prize that the one survivor gets, that I'm willing to risk becoming one of the 99% of the contestants who get shot dead if they stop for more than 60 seconds, whatever the rule is. No, thank you, that sounds horrific. So no, it'd be understandable you turn down stuff like that. We're not all into extreme adventures and things. But no, if you're offered the opportunity to get into a lifeboat, no matter how extreme it sounds, I would say accept that. You never know what might come of it. Your survival might come of it. Maybe you haven't realized you're in a plane that's landed on water and it's not going to stay landed on water for long, I can tell you. Because it's not actually a boat. Or you might be in a boat that's on water that's designed to stay floating for long. But there's some issue, and that's why people are offering you the opportunity to get into a lifeboat. If someone is offering you an opportunity to get into a lifeboat, that's something you should accept, even if you don't know why they're doing it yet. Just trust that it's probably a good idea to take that. Because I can tell you, once that invitation gets withdrawn, someone else is going to snap that up probably, and they'd be very wise to do so. So, no, accept that. Unless you're one of those people who know what's going on, you think, oh no, women and children first, and I'm not a woman or a children, so I'll hang on, no thank you, and then you reject the invitation. Or maybe you're very good at swimming. You're very, very, very good at swimming and you're thinking, no, I don't need a vehicle for swimming. That's like someone who's a marathon runner. They're a sprinter. They're very good at running. They can run like your man Tom Hanks in that movie where he plays the unrealistic, intellectually disabled man. There's a scene where they depict him running everywhere, running all over America. If you're someone who can run like that, you might turn down the opportunity to get into a car. You're running like that, someone offers you a lift, you say, no, thank you. So maybe there's an equivalent of that for swimmers. If you're very, very good at swimming, you might turn down an invitation to get into a boat, especially if you're not really a people person, as I'm not. But I can't swim, unfortunately. If I could swim and I was in that situation, I'd offer the opportunity to get into a packed lifeboat and sit there. If I happen to be very, very, very good at swimming, confident that I could swim 300 miles to shore without dying or anything and even enjoy it, I'd be very much up for rejecting that place on the lifeboat. That's rather unrealistic, since I can't even swim. So no, don't do that. As a general rule, I think we're approaching the end of today's episode of Into Your Head, the podcast. Now, that puts limitations on this segment. If I start by saying I think we're approaching the end, then I have to put this near the end. So why am I doing this? I think I just like the idea of there being an end. I like having an end, especially if it's a long episode, as this seems to be turning out to be. I like to have an ending on it and not just fade away and sound like I haven't planned anything for an ending. Just ends with me going anyway, and then the cat walks up to the bar and says, can I have 2 pints of your finest Guinness, please? And then the music just fades in and that's it. No, that makes me sound like a complete amateur if I do stuff like that. Now, admittedly, I am an amateur. This is an amateur production. It's an amateur production. I bought in all the content from elsewhere, just like you do if you're an amateur dramatic society. You buy in the rights to put on Andrew Lloyd Webber's Cats, perhaps, and you put on an amateur production of that. That's what I'm doing here. I'm putting on an amateur production of Into Your Head, a podcast that comes prepackaged with all the characters and scripts all done up. The original production of Into Your Head is very, very different from this, I can tell you. You probably know because you have internet, so I don't know how that works. Is the original Into Your Head available in the market where you're getting this? I thought I had the worldwide rights to this. I don't know. Suppose in a way it doesn't really matter because this is all bullshit. But just want a way to end the show. I suppose that's a novel way. Does that make sense? I just wanted to have an ending. Is that too much to ask? No. I want to put in an ending and I'm kind of done for today. So that's all that's going to be in it. I think it was a fairly original concept. Even if I didn't perform it particularly well, do anything particularly good with it. And I'm being modest about it now as well. That's endearing. The fact that I'm being modest about the quality of this ending. So that's good as well. Anyway, good morning.